why don't you say something? You could say testing, one, two, three.
My name is Barry Trost.
Fine, okay. This is an interview with Barry Trost on the 26th of November, 1985. I'm Morris Mayle, doing the interview for the University Archives Oral History Project. We're talking in his office in the chemistry building. Did you get a chance to look at any of the material that I left, David Federman's interview?
Yeah, I looked at some of the material. I must say I didn't have a chance to go through all of the aspects of the interview process, all the things. Obviously, there are different issues that different people have in terms of the kinds of things that are that arise as far as the university is concerned.
Well, today, I suppose we'll spend most of the time on what you did before you came to the university, and just to begin with, your family and your childhood environment.
Well, I was born in Philadelphia and grew up in the city. I spent my entire public school life through my undergraduate years. My family largely was also located in Philadelphia. My grandparents had emigrated from Russia into the United States. My father, as a young boy, also had emigrated with his parents from Russia to the United States. So they all have Russian backgrounds. Both of their families settled in the Philadelphia area. And so we had, in fact, a fairly large family unit that was located there. My parents my father was the oldest of eight children, and my mother was the youngest of three children. And those families also have now families and are all still in that area of the country. I have a brother, and he is in business in the city of Philadelphia. I was the first from my family to actually attend universities.
What did your father do?
My father was a small businessman. He had manufactured braided rugs. This was a trade that he developed from his father, and he continued to doing that until he was around 40 years of age, or 50 years of age, when the competition from the Japanese and others in the Far East put him out of business. It's a labor-intensive type of activity. And then he went into retail business and was in store. He owned several stores for a while, and now he's retired.
And was there any, had he had any education, or your mother, or was there an environment of reading in the family? Interest in politics, which seems to be another.
No, not really. My father, as I mentioned, was the oldest of eight children, and as a result of that, he had a fairly high responsibility to help to contribute to the family in the early days when they especially first arrived. So his parents pulled him out of school at as early an age as was legally allowed. So he, in fact, never finished the normal secondary education. My mother went through secondary school, she had completed, but she had not gone beyond that. They always valued education as a way of not only improving oneself, but also as a way of opening opportunities. So there, while they didn't have formal educations beyond the secondary school level, they felt that this was an important aspect. Unfortunately, for various reasons, in part related to health, my brother did not go on to universities. He's an older brother. Mm-hmm. So I became the first one who actually went that far.
But so you expected to from a child, from childhood?
I guess I never consciously made a decision that this is something that I was going to do, although it sort of was always something that I assumed I would do. It never dawned on me that this is something I should not be doing. Mm-hmm. I assumed and went through essentially all of the primary and secondary school with the ultimate notion that I would be going on to a university, not ever asking the question as to in what areas, what fields of study. It was just that this was the proper thing for me to do. And I think my brother would have probably followed the same course, except that he did have some health problems, which made it hard for him to actually engage in the kinds of intensive activity, especially at the high school level. So he academically did not do very well, and as a result of that, just didn't lead him to continue in that kind of enterprise. In my own case, I did very well academically, and so it was always a stimulus rather than a deterrent for me.
Were they good schools in Philadelphia?
I feel I have had a very good opportunity in the schools that I went to. The Philadelphia public school system, and it was the public school system at that time, had at almost every level. At that time, they were elementary, junior high, and high schools. That's what we call now the elementary, middle, and high schools. And all levels, I feel that the preparations that I've gotten, the challenges that were given, prepared me very well for what was necessary later. I don't think that I saw any indications that the educational level there would not have been comparable to what we feel is the excellent educational level that's available here in the city, for example. I think it was true, although I don't get the feeling today as I go back to Philadelphia that is the case anymore.
So what kind of person were you in high school?
Well, I would have to say that I was sort of somewhat introverted, if you want. I spent a lot of time getting involved in school activities. I did spend a lot of time studying and getting involved in academically oriented projects. I did get involved in a number of the intellectual type of extracurricular activities rather than the sports types of extracurricular activities. I was never very sports-like, although I can enjoy some activities like swimming and tennis. I am certainly not a sportsman. And so I would get involved in things like language clubs, math clubs, science clubs. I guess the most social thing was getting in on the annual yearbook, but in an editorial capacity.
So you weren't strictly a scientist in high school?
No, I was not strictly a scientist. I enjoyed languages very much. I enjoy other aspects. Photography was also something that interested me, and I actually got involved in some of the photographic aspects of the annual yearbooks, for example. But science did play a fairly large role. Again, I guess it was the curiosity as a young boy wondering what happens and why things happen, and playing around with various science sets. Starting out when you are, say, a pre-teenager, that probably moved me more than anything else into science as a career.
You mean you got chemistry sets? You were given chemistry sets?
Oh, yeah. I was given chemistry sets and physics sets and all these other kinds of things that were available for children at the time. And we also had our little share of pranks of making bad smells and other things. One time having a rather bad fire, actually. Fortunately, no serious damage, but sure scared me at the time. But that's certainly initiated my exposure to science, and the fact that science was a type of intellectual curiosity that would be a very challenging one.
Did when I look through your curriculum vitae here, you do a very great deal. Do you, your habits of work and sort of concentration, do they start back then? Did you get them from your parents?
Yeah, I would have to say that my habits, as far as the ability of concentrating when a lot of things are going on, grew up as I grew up. I always was in the habit of doing more than one thing at a time. So if I was studying, I was also listening to something else or watching a television as well as studying. And somehow I was able to do those things all together.
I gotta shut the door. So it was a family thing or mostly just you?
Well, I would have to say that my father also was somebody who always had to be doing things, always had to have something happening. And being in a small business, he had to do almost everything from being the accountant to being the salesman to being the person who actually is making the rugs. So he was always having to intertwine these kinds of activities to have them all come together to in fact be successful. And he was up to a limited period of time. So I guess I would have to trace at least some aspects of the needs for one to be able to accomplish more than a single task would have permit you at a time probably came from him. But it also was, again, I guess one sort of gets involved in that, not in a conscious way, but in an unconscious way, where it just seemed to be natural to do that rather than something that I consciously said I have to do. I just did it. But I think it was a learned experience from seeing what was going on around me, especially in what my father was trying to do. The idea of working hard and seeing rewards for that to a large measure came from him. He worked very hard his entire life. To him, it was not only a way of earning a living, it was also an enjoyable thing to do. So it was not simply a job for economic survival, but it was something that was a creation. It was a part of life, and one that could be as enjoyable as other things that we take as entertainment value. And I think that that idea certainly has been an important aspect of myself. I don't think one can get involved in science with the degree of intensity that one needs to get involved unless you really begin enjoying it as an intellectual and as an entertainment, if you want. It's fun. And if it isn't fun, then it becomes a great chore. And I think that notion really goes back to my family. And probably more specifically to my father than anyone else. I don't know what else.
Well, you said last time that you thought your interest in chemistry dated from high school.
Okay. As I look over my career, my first contacts with chemistry really did come from these things as a childhood. But the notion that this might be something that one would take seriously, in other words, that you might actually have a career in it, got started in high school. If you look at the science curriculum that it evolves in the primary and secondary schools, while you're introduced to science in some ways in primary schools, it's never in a fashion, at least it wasn't in a fashion at that time, that one would begin really thinking that this is something that isn't all known, but that there is a lot that is unknown, and that it could in fact offer opportunities. This came when I took high school chemistry, and again, while a lot of it is just going through the rotes of doing experiments that are well worked out so that it's safe for teenagers to do and yet learn something, the excitement that could be present in chemistry began to be first really demonstrated at that stage. To have a person who had been teaching in the public school systems in Philadelphia for 30 years at that point in time, and yet to retain an enthusiasm and excitement of what the subject had and many of the things that were still unknown, probably had a very strong influence. Certainly by the time I went through that, which was as a junior in high school, there was no question in my mind that entering the university it would be entering in chemistry. While many people, when they went to a university, went with not a particular notion as to what they would want to major in. And as today, many entered as just general liberal arts majors and wouldn't decide until 1 or 2 years later as to what they might ultimately major in. I didn't have any questions about that. I entered as a freshman in the liberal arts school, but with a major in chemistry. And so I was able to begin my chemistry career rather straight off. I always seemed to be in a hurry, too. So I graduated in the public school systems in mid-semester, which meant in the end of January. Again, it was sort of an accident of circumstance as to where I ended up for universities, because coming from a family which was not economically well off, I felt that I had the obligation more or less to support myself. So the notion of staying in the city of Philadelphia always existed, so that I basically could commute from home and not have to live away. And the fact that Philadelphia had a substantial number of universities that one could go to, and fairly good ones. Well, the one that I had chosen was Drexel Institute of Technology, actually, because they had a cooperative program where one could be at the institute for part of the year, and they had industry affiliates where you could also work in industry as part of your educational experience for part of the year. And indeed, I was all set to enter Drexel until about 2 weeks before graduation, where it turned out that I was the top graduate in the class. And as the top graduate in the class, you're automatically given a fellowship or scholarship to University of Pennsylvania. That's one thing that they did in the public school systems to, in essence, recruit the top students in the city. The only problem was I hadn't applied to the University of Pennsylvania. So the first thing I had to do was to actually get an application to them for them to act on prior to graduation so that I could enter the university, because it turns out that the registration for their spring term was happening 2 days before graduation. So it was a rather hectic period of time for having me to apply and they having to go through the process of accepting me and to having to register all in a matter of about 5 days. But
And you very excited about this?
Yes, there was no question that the opportunity of being able to go to the University of Pennsylvania rather than Drexel was something I felt would be very, very important for my own career, that Drexel wasn't so much a choice based on the academic excellence that it offered versus Penn, but it really was an economic decision. Mm-hmm. And not having to rely on an economic decision, that to go to a school where I felt from an educational point of view that I could have a much better opportunity, really offered a tremendously exciting challenge. And so I was exceedingly excited about the prospects of doing that.
None of your teachers had talked to you about what you were going to do after high school?
No. They did have a counseling service available in the high schools, but it never really occurred to me to use it.
But I met your teachers as knowing that you were very bright and wondering what was going to happen to you.
No, I don't. I don't recall a situation where the teachers, in general, took enough of a personal interest that they involved themselves in things of that kind. The only one who ever did that was my math teacher, actually, as I recall back, in which he was trying to excite me about prospects of math as a career, and got me involved in several citywide activities as a result of that. But they didn't counsel me specifically on what my future plans were, beyond the fact that that I was in a program which more or less was defined to be a group of students who were going to go to universities. At this point in the public school system, it was fashionable to have what they called accelerated classes. So entering at high school, they differentiated among students, not only in the sense that students who were going to explore a curriculum which was more or less generally preparations for universities, and students who were going to more or less terminate their education at the secondary level and therefore look to have a larger number of trade type of classes. They also, among the university-bound students, established a class of accelerated students who followed a curriculum in which they were in the same class for each of the subjects, so that we took the language subjects together, the math subjects together, the science subjects together, etc. And in that sense, it was more or less assumed that everybody in this class were going to go to universities. And I don't think that gets the teachers, as a result of that, felt the need to have any further specific interactions. Mm-hmm. But they didn't seem to go the stage of, let's say, talking to me specifically about what schools would be good schools to go to, what would be the ways to apply to these. We were sort of in this in-between financial situation in that we were not financially so well bad off that I would be eligible for special assistance,
yeah.
But we're not particularly well, you know, we're at the lower end of the middle class, in other words, and that made it rather difficult financially, and I always felt that I had to sort of take care of myself rather than having to rely on my parents. And staying at home and having them support me in that way was, say, enough to ask of them, and that if I could at least support myself to as much as possible through the university, I would try to do that. I guess it didn't also matter a lot to me. I didn't think enough about it as far as what it might mean in terms of future opportunities. That is, the importance that the choice of a university has on what are the future career opportunities for an individual. I wasn't sophisticated enough at that age to realize that aspect of it. In that sense, it would have been very important if the teachers perhaps would have spoken to me about it. In the end, it worked out all right, but it was really by accident rather than by design. I was very fortunate, and as I said, I did spend a lot of time on schoolwork, and so I did succeed in being the first, not only overall, but in virtually all of the subjects, and they'd still had the traditions of giving out prizes, and of the 10 prizes that were available for the top student in each of the various things, I got something like 6 or 7 of them.
Really?
So it was a very exciting, event at the end of high school. It was an exciting evening, and one in which, in principle, you were not supposed to know any of this. You're standing in the class, nor any of these other things, until the evening of graduation.
So it was a complete surprise to you.
So it was,
and your parents.
It was a complete surprise, and as I said, it caused this problem. Because I hadn't applied to Penn,
yeah.
So that if something had happened earlier, so that's the only way I did know that, as far as where I was going to stand in the class, when they had told me that I was going to receive this scholarship, but they needed to have me apply for admittance in order for me to receive it. I think that's one of the weaknesses that does come out in the school system. The classes there, let's say we had about 35 students in the class. And of course, while we were in an accelerated class, the teachers only had us for one period of the day. So they had our class, for which more was expected of them as was expected of us. But they also, of course, had, I don't know, 5 or 6 other classes to handle. And if you add up the number of students that each one has to handle, it was quite a demanding task. And to have them spend time individually with people would have been asking a lot, I think. Again, it's not something that I gave any real thought to. I tend to be a rather independent individual, as you might have gathered. And there are very few times in my life that I didn't know what it is I wanted to do. I would say there's only one time where that actually happened, and that happened very recently rather than early on. But maybe we'll get to that later on. But at this point, at that stage, the stage as I grew up, there were very little questions as to what I wanted to do, although as far as two rather important events, where I went to university as an undergraduate and where I went to a university as a graduate student, both of those events essentially happened at the last minute, rather than being very carefully and planned. What eventually turned out literally happened at the last minute. The situation with the undergraduate schools repeated itself at the graduate level. Not quite the same way.
Okay, well, let's wait on that. We just have a bit more. So, talk about college then.
Again, I was a young man in a hurry. I entered, as I mentioned, in January of 1959. So for some reason, I wanted to go through my undergraduate years as rapidly as possible. So instead of spending 4 years, I only spent a little more than 3 years by, say, taking very heavy course loads each of the semesters and spending a summer and taking additional courses. And in that way, I was able to slop off a semester from my undergraduate careers.
Do you know why you were in a hurry?
Well, I guess I just wanted to be able to do as much as possible. And that meant getting everything done in as short a period of time.
In your life?
In my life. So it was not just that I wanted to get through the undergraduate in a hurry, but it was just a way of a way of approaching doing anything that I think it's important for me to try to accomplish as much as I can in my lifetime. And this means trying to do whatever I'm setting out to do in as short a period of time as possible. Going through universities was the first time that I could seriously, say, affect the timetable in which I was going to be moving ahead, and I did. As I said, I came directly in with no hesitation as to what I wanted to do as far as my major. And I started in the chemistry program. I chose a Bachelor of Science degree rather than a Bachelor of Arts degree, mainly because it would allow me to proceed through the science curriculum at a more rapid rate without having to get bogged down into the same numbers and requirements outside of the science area. Because at that point in time, I didn't really want to, say, divert my attentions away from moving myself through the university system in the most straightforward direction as possible. I did narrow myself a lot in that.
Have you ever regretted that?
No. I can't. I think for me, it turned out to be very, very good. I enjoyed a number of the other things that I did. As I mentioned before, I enjoyed languages. So in the university, I continued my interest. In that time, it was in French, and I started an interest in German, and I became quite fluent in both at the time. I went through and to advance courses in French literature, which I enjoyed a great deal, reading French plays and French novels. Unfortunately, I never took the time to actually spend time in a French-speaking part of the world, either in French Quebec or in Canada or over in France, and that was unfortunate. Now I sort of regret that aspect, that I really didn't have the time to be able to get involved in the cultures that one is able to when you can really speak a language.
Wait.
To today, I think it's rather unfortunate that I didn't reinforce my ability of dealing with these languages so well by spending that time, because one loses it. I have not ever lived in a French-speaking part of the world for any period of time, and while I certainly still have a cognizance of French, it's not at a level which I would be comfortable in using in, let's say, sitting with my French colleagues and trying to converse with them in French rather than resorting to English, because in chemistry they do know English. And similarly in German, my knowledge of German never quite got to be as good as my knowledge of French. And there, however, I have spent time in Germany, and there I probably feel a little bit more comfortable with it. I always was interested in international affairs. World history always fascinated me, and I took a lot of history courses because of that. So language courses and history courses I enjoyed a great deal. I enjoyed American history, the political events that shaped the U.S., especially in the 1800s and early 1900s, were very, very fascinating. History and languages were two areas that I did spend a lot of time on because I enjoyed them. But what I didn't spend a lot of time on because I didn't enjoy would be, for example, American literature or creative writing. These are things that had rather low priorities as far as my educational experience at the University of Pennsylvania was concerned.
Do you think your students do as much non-science things as you did?
I don't see that, at least in terms of the same degree of choices that they might make. They seem to one is that the curriculum that they tend to go through, at least as undergraduates, are as Bachelor of Arts, which is a much more structured curriculum than the, as I mentioned, the Bachelor of Science curriculum was there. It was a more flexible one. It was set up in a way to facilitate some things by not giving you the same range of requirements. That offered me the opportunity of, say, taking some of these other types of electives that one might not have otherwise taken because you had a more structured type of curriculum.
Oh, I see. So you were able to get more history and more language because you didn't have to do
the other thing. Right. Yes. I didn't have to take the English, or I didn't have to take the other things that I didn't enjoy very much. Mm-hmm. As a result of that, I was able to take advanced courses in French literature, for example, and to take advanced courses in history.
Much smarter.
So I was able to follow those areas which I found more interesting and not those that I didn't find quite as interesting. And I think at the present time, the curriculum that most students followed would be more comparable to what would have been available to me through the Bachelor of Arts degree, where there it is a much more structured environment. We have a situation where if you combine, for a science-oriented student, the number of requirements plus the number of outside requirements is a case where that takes almost all of the available time that they have. So I don't think we give them as quite the same flexibility in that respect. I think that I tended to feel that it was more important to become an expert in areas rather than to be more of a generalist. I think that probably also influenced me a great deal in that respect. And the notion today is more that students should be more, at least at that stage in their career, should be more generalists, and they don't feel the need to become more of an expert in the field. And I think that that philosophy certainly was very prevalent for a long time, and it's still fairly prevalent at the undergraduate level. We still say it's very important for students to become an educated person, that they should be at least aware of these other areas, and the undergraduate level should not be too concentrated in an area. And this notion is still fairly well accepted, and students, I think, are very much influenced by that. My notion of becoming more an expert, which I still have,
probably had more of an influence on me in doing it the way I did. So I think in part it's the philosophy of education that plays a role there. I didn't have any hesitations that what one wanted to do. And if you wanted to do something, I felt you wanted to do it well and you wanted to know what you were doing. And to do that, you had to become an expert. You couldn't just be a generalist. As I look at what I was able to do and being able to concentrate on the kinds of courses that I enjoyed, academically I did very well. I became a Phi Beta Kappa as a junior. That's not happens very frequently, especially if you consider that I entered a half a year later than all the other juniors. So I was really an advanced sophomore rather than an honest junior, in this, at least in the sense of how many semesters I had gone through. Okay, I had gone through one less semester than all the other juniors, and yet I was still elected to the to Phi Beta at that time. And as I look at, so academically it was not a problem for me. At the university, I had probably one of the most stimulating teachers I ever had, and that was a teacher who taught organic chemistry. And the whole approach that I see in myself, in many ways I can attribute to the way that he approached science in general and organic chemistry in particular. Many of the students who went through his classes, and I'm not just science-oriented students, but non-science-oriented students, came away from his classes and just his approach to science in a very special way. And it was really very important to me that he actually took an interest in me and did things for me without my ever asking. He had some influence with some of the local research laboratories and arranged summer jobs for me. Came to me one time and asked if I would be interested in doing this. And that, he thought it would be good for me to spend a summer working in a research lab to see what it's like. And that also had a big influence on me, I must say, in terms of where I went for graduate schools and what kind of science I was going to pursue in graduate school. His approach was somewhat in a low-key sense, in that he wasn't an overly excitable type of individual that really tends to drum up one's enthusiasm, but it was a very secure way of, that's not the right words, a very systematic way of being able to understand complex phenomena and be able to explain these phenomena in a way that people who had no previous experience with it could actually understand it and not just be snowed by it, but could begin to understand what he was actually saying. And yet to also transmit the ideas that there's a lot of exciting things yet to be done. One of the real problems in teaching is always the question of you want to show your knowledge or how knowledgeable you are by giving the impression you know all, but on the other hand, you also want to transmit the idea that there's a lot of things that are just unknown. And that's a conflict that many teachers have. He was able to handle this conflict very well and probably had, as I said, more influence on me than almost any teacher I can imagine, that I can think of. He was not an individual who had achieved a lot of fame as a scientist. Although in many ways he was very much ahead of his times. He wrote a book in the 1940s at a time dealing with an aspect of chemistry which was not realized to be a very important one.
What was it?
This was dealing with what we call mechanisms of reactions. And this notion of understanding chemical reactions based on mechanisms was not something that was done. Everything was done in a descriptive way. You mixed A with B and you got a bright yellow color. Or you mixed A with B and this is the product you got. And people didn't spend very much time in trying to understand the physical, chemical bases for why mixing A with B should allow you to predict that C would be the result. There were empirical rules that evolved in chemistry, and we learned things based on what we call name reactions. That is, a person would more or less mix things at random, get a product, and would able to show whether this is general or not general, and then his name became associated with that process. And it was really a matter of sheer rote. Mm-hmm. And organic chemistry gets a very bad name, even today, because it's said that you have to have a tremendous memory in order to be able to be successful in organic chemistry. That there's nothing that one can understand, it's just a matter of memorization. But what he did, and this is at really an early stage, was actually try to transmute that into one of understanding rather than one of rote memorization. That one could, in fact, have underlying basic principles, and from these understand, and by understanding, predict. And it was, not only was he able to do this without having the scientific background for a lot of this, in other words, the experimental evidence that this kind of fundamental phenomenon really existed wasn't there for a lot of the things, but that one could see these generalizations evolve. And then organizing an undergraduate course in a way of that fashion was just unheard of. The textbooks of the time were just not done that way. And his book, because it was not fitting the mold, wasn't one that people would have adopted. It wasn't at the major places, the major centers of organic chemistry, places like Harvard, Illinois. These were really the major centers, and Wisconsin. That's not the way one teaches organic chemistry. That's not the way it was done, at least at that time.
But it became so later.
Well, it's more so now than it was.
Isn't theoretical chemistry.
No. It's not theoretical chemistry. It's what one calls mechanistic organic chemistry. Mm. This is understanding, by understanding structure, and when I say understanding structure, I mean understanding electronic structure, in part by some of the feed-in that comes from theoretical chemistry, molecular orbital theory. These aspects allow you to understand how you can change structure, and that's what reactions are all about. The period of time when people began really making these kinds of systematic understandings of reaction mechanisms started in the 1940s. So he wrote a book at the time when these things were just starting. As you go through the period, the 1950s and certainly the 1960s is where this aspect of the science has exploded. That's when it really took off, so that today, the undergraduate textbooks all have at least some fairly major component of helping students to really just to understand, not just memorize. Although many still try to practice the memorization and forget about the understanding. There have been some books that have come along, and one by some very famous people in mechanistic organic chemistry, which were written in the 1960s about, 20 years after this man's name is Alan Day, about 20 years after Day's first book, and 5 years after his second book, which was really an undergraduate-oriented textbook. Their book this was a book written by Cram and Hammond, two premier practitioners of mechanistic organic chemistry. And their book was a disaster from the point of view of being understandable by most undergraduate students. But it was written solely from the point of view of this mechanistic kind of approach, this understanding of reactivity, rather than the this rote memorization approach. In contrast, Day had a nice combination of trying to present things in this mechanistic type of fashion, but also with enough descriptive chemistry that it was interesting to students, and ones where it was stimulated them enough that they wanted to learn, and it was in a fashion that they were able to understand. And that was his real special ability. And he fortunately continued teaching until well into his 70s. And I just learned that he retired not long ago, totally. He's in his 80s now. And he's not far from Madison. His daughter lives just outside the city of Madison, and he now, in fact, is here in Wisconsin. So it's a little ironic to see how these things have come about. That he lived his entire life his entire professional life, at least, in Philadelphia. Eventually, I moved to Madison, and he's not far away now. Unfortunately, I haven't seen him since he moved here, because I just learned this last April that he has. Subsequently moved to Madison, or not, that's a suburb of Madison, actually.
Was he recognized eventually?
No, I'd say that people don't feel the way I do about his book. I think it was one of the most advanced books at the time. I probably would have to agree that in today's world, it's not up to date any longer. Its last edition was 1965, and at the rate at which science progresses, that's not adequate. But at the time, I think it was probably one of the best books. And as I look back and I see all the other ones that people have used, I still would come to that conclusion. Yeah. But it's not something that I think people have recognized or are likely to recognize. He just never had enough scientific stature for people to want to spend the time.
Because this wasn't research, in fact, it was a way of looking at.
Right. It was really a matter of a way of presenting the material in a fashion that was more understandable, rather than presenting it in this overwhelming memorization approach.
Did he have graduate students?
Yes, he had graduate students. Not very many. I cannot, even today, think of what his true scientific contributions have been. So
he really was one of these people who was a teacher.
He was really a teacher more than a researcher, yes. Penn, at this period of time, was not a place where science was given any particular attention. And one would have to say that scientifically, across the board, it was not one of the major centers in the United States. You would take Penn in the 1960s when I attended and compare it to Madison. There is just no comparability in terms of the overall quality of the programs. Madison, it was infinitely better. I mean, just powers of 10 better than Penn.
So you were just lucky. Was he the only man that you encountered that inspired you there? Are there others?
I would have to say that nobody had as strong an influence on me as he did. There was, however, another man there who had quite a bit of influence, in the sense that it was the influence of the second man, a man named Ed Thornton, who essentially decided where I went to graduate school. And again, as I mentioned before, that had that happened also at sort of at the last minute. But Alan Day was in a department where research was not all that intense an activity. And the number of people who were involved in research on the faculty at large, while they all had some kind of research activities, the number of people who would be involved in research, let's say at a national level or an international level, would be relatively limited, just a handful at most. And as a result of that, the department did not have the same quality programs. Where it hurt most was at the advanced offerings. Mm-hmm. So at the introductory level programs, it probably wasn't too bad off. The people were certainly aware of the developments, and I can only compare the kind of background I had as I entered now the next level of education, yeah, would be the graduate level, and find that did not find myself at a disadvantage vis-a-vis to the other people, that the level of education that I was able to have, and the fact that I did get involved more or less by my own activities in research, doing advanced studying, learning things at advanced levels on my own, not necessarily just relying on courses, that I didn't have a problem.
Do any of your significant research discoveries start there?
It didn't start at the University of Pennsylvania. One area of research that we became involved in subsequently did start, however, on one of these summers that I mentioned. Alan Day had arranged for me to work at a local pharmaceutical company, Smith, Kline & French, who were located in the center of Philadelphia, not very far away from the University of Pennsylvania. And that also had a tremendous influence on me. It turned out that I was able to be working with a senior chemist there who had been an assistant professor at Northwestern University. Again, it's a relatively small world because he and Professor Howard Zimmerman, who is on our faculty here, both started their academic careers at Northwestern University at the same time. Zimmerman eventually came to Madison, and this man's name was Weinstock. Joe Weinstock came to Smith, Kline & French. And so, having had that academic background, not only was he a good scientist and doing nice things there, he was also interested in teaching. And so I was a pupil for him as well. And I learned an awful lot from him. He very much reinforced the kinds of things that Day did. But one of the projects I got involved in as a undergraduate student studying at Smith, Kline & French did evolve ultimately into an area of research that we carried out here many, many years later. They introduced me to an aspect of chemistry that was at a very early stage in which it was just developing. They were trying to apply this new developments in trying to synthesize a particular psychotic agent that they were trying to develop. And that chemistry intrigued me a great deal, and I maintained an interest in that all through graduate school, though I didn't do very much chemistry in that area during graduate school. But when I came here, it was an area that I initiated again. So, some of our research goes back to that time. I look at my stay both at the University of Pennsylvania and at Smith Kline as ones that were exceedingly, one, enjoyable and very fruitful, because as I mentioned, I think I learned an awful lot from the people I was able to interact with there. So it really was the people more than the courses. I think Penn has changed a lot in their re-emphasizing of science, but it was, for me, a good experience. There are, in chemistry, like any other fields, there are sub-disciplines, so that if one looks at science, or looks at chemistry, organic chemistry, there are mechanistic organic chemistry, which we talked about a little bit in terms of how one teaches. There's synthetic organic chemistry. There's natural products chemistry. There's and many, many, many others.
Yeah.
If I look back to the days when I was an undergraduate student, and I would include then that experience I had at Smith, Kline & French, these would be aspects of what I would call synthetic chemistry. Mm-hmm. And obviously the times at Smith, Kline & French, it would be synthetic chemistry directed towards pharmaceuticals. Certainly those experiences have had a strong imprint in the directions that I was ultimately interested in, because if I look to today, to what we have been doing for the last two decades, they certainly fall into the classification of one, synthetic chemistry, and today more than ever, synthetic chemistry that has a biological implication. So yes, I would say that the general fields of research that sort of turned me on at the time and that I was exposed to at the time have carried through. Now the specifics change a lot. Mm-hmm. So it's one thing to say one's involved in synthetic chemistry or involved in chemistry that's related to biologically active types of molecules, but what that means as far as the kind of specific types of reactions one does or the specific kinds of molecules that one's interested in, these are totally different and these evolve with time. What's at the forefront today is not what was at the forefront a year ago and will not be at the forefront a year from now. That is, that the pace of change is at such a high level that the specifics of what constitutes synthetic chemistry or interesting natural products chemistry or interesting biologically active systems, etc., really does change essentially at that kind of rate. So it's going to be unlike the humanities where you might be studying a period of time or you might be studying some aspects of a period of time, but that's always been there. Okay, mm-hmm. And you might go into looking at it from another viewpoint, or you might look at it from another individual or group of individuals who existed at that time. Here, one's talking about something that is totally, it's not something that's there, it's something that's changing. And only the general field is there, but how that field is practiced and perceived changes from one period of time to another. So certainly I can say that the general areas evolve from that period.
There's no underlying motivation than pure curiosity, is there? I mean, you're not trying to discover the reason for a disease or how the universe started.
No, I have to. In my own case, my drive really comes just out of the excitement of discovering something that hadn't been known before. Mm-hmm. This is the prime motivation. Sure, we would like to discover things that would have some other kinds of spin-offs that would lead to practical developments, etc. But while we certainly would be very pleased if that happened, it's not the prime motivational force.
Mm-hmm. This is take two of the interview with Barry Trost.
Well, there are some individuals in science who have as their major motivational force the notion that they want to do a specific task. They want to make a new fiber. They want to make, or they want to discover a new vaccine for a particular disease. And that is a very valid and a very important kind of motivational force. But it need not be and should not be the only kinds of motivational forces that are important in society. It's hard to know what are going to be the important problems from tomorrow, and there should be some people who are just excited about the science in and of itself and the idea and the process of discovery of new things makes it a challenge and something that is important to do. And I have to say that my own approach, really is of that latter category. Mm-hmm. But we would very much like to see some of our discoveries lead into practical aspects of solving some real problems that are here now, not only providing the basis for solutions to problems that might exist tomorrow. And we do a little bit of that aspect of, say, getting some things patented or trying to see whether some of our discoveries could apply to some things that we know already are of some practical interest today. So we do that a little bit, but it's only a small part of our activities. It's really the discovery process that excites us and that keeps us going. And I think that in our world, I hope we always have some room for people that have that as a prime mode of operation. After all, that's really what the future is all about. It's really the fact that we don't know what it is, and just new discovery is what's going to provide the new opportunities in the future. And that has to be done on the basis that, well, we don't know what direction we want to go in.
You felt this as an undergraduate too.
Yes, throughout my whole academic career, the main thing that was always stimulating me is just learning something different and new.
rather than worrying whether this something different and new helped me do some specific thing. Mm-hmm. Just the act of learning is what was exciting. And I never really thought about the question, well, is this going to be good for something? I really thought about the fact that, gee, it's interesting. And then I still try to approach science that way. So I think that pervaded all the way back, at least as far as I can remember back.
So when you got towards the end of your senior year, you knew you wanted to go to graduate school. And did you know what you wanted to do already?
As I mentioned, I had already more or less got myself established in doing some things in synthetic chemistry. And the idea that wherever I was going to go, probably was going to study some areas of synthetic chemistry. Again, it was a rather curious situation because I had this notion of going to Columbia for graduate school. I had applied to a number of schools. In fact, one of the schools I applied to was Wisconsin. That was the most distant school I had applied to because of the excellence of the program that was here. And I knew a lot about the program here. Unlike the situation in high school, because I was doing senior work at the University of Pennsylvania, I was doing research work, I had a lot of interaction with the faculty on a personal basis, mm-hmm. and they gave me a lot of advice about places, and Wisconsin was ranked very high as a good place to come for graduate school. But I have to also say that I didn't really seriously consider it because it just seemed to me it was too far away. Mm-hmm. Most students tend to be rather provincial, and I guess I fell into that trap as well. Probably more so than others because I had spent my undergraduate years in the same city in which I was born. So I really had never gone very far away from the area that I knew very well for 20 years now. So my notion was, so I had applied mainly to Wisconsin, Columbia, actually one other school. I can't remember what the other school was.
Cornell?
No, it wasn't. Someplace in Ohio. It wasn't Ohio State, though. But my idea really was to go to Columbia. It had some well-known people there. It also didn't seem to be too far away from my old home ground, and so it looked to me like it was a good combination of an excellent graduate school and a place that had people that were working in areas that seemed to be of interest to me and a location that was acceptable to me. Then at that point in time, as I mentioned, I was sort of in this rather unusual situation of having accelerated because of taking in heavier loads and earlier and taking more classes during the summer. So I had applied to these schools and more or less had all things set to go to Columbia, and then I started to do some research with a newly arrived young faculty member who happened to obtain his degree from MIT. And he had done a postdoctoral study at Harvard and then came to teach at University of Pennsylvania. And Alan Day had recommended that it would be good for me to do research with this bright young guy who just arrived in the department. So I started to do research with him. And he started to talk to me about graduate schools. And again, this was rather late in the year. It was in February, and it was more or less at a time when, at that point in time, the deadlines were more or less as they are today, that March 15th was more or less, was the time in which everything was established. But it was more the traditions for students to apply to graduate schools early in the fall semester, mm-hmm. September, October, and usually by December, everything was all set, as it was, at least as I thought it was.
And I started to do graduate work, or research with Ed Thornton. And he started to talk to me about graduate schools and asked if I had applied to either Harvard or MIT. And I said, no, I hadn't applied to Harvard or MIT. I really didn't think about doing that. He says, well, you really should apply to Harvard and MIT. They're two of the best schools in the country, and you really should give some thought to that. So being some of the better schools in the country, I thought, well, I really wasn't going to seriously consider going there, but it wouldn't hurt for me to apply and just see what would happen. So I applied to both Harvard and MIT, and I got accepted at both, and decided that, well, largely under his prodding, that maybe I shouldn't go to Columbia. I don't know what he had against Columbia at the time, but I eventually ended up going to MIT.
Why?
I wish I could say that there was some really single rational reason. It was really his influence. He pointed out one thing, which is true, that it was a larger department than Columbia. And being a larger department, it had a little more opportunity in terms of the range of work that was being done there.
You're not talking about people, evidently.
I'm talking about people. It's a larger...
In particular...
If you look at the department and how many people are doing research in organic chemistry, it's a larger number of people.
But there isn't some particular great man that you want to study with.
No, at that point in time, I was not oriented directly towards a single individual. Again, I would have to say that was probably the fact that I was not so familiar with individuals as much as areas. Mm-hmm. At Columbia, I was oriented towards working with a particular man, as it turns out, a man named Gilbert Stork, who turns out also to be a Wisconsin PhD. So he had gotten his degree here with Sam McElvain, and had been teaching at Columbia for many years. And today, he's now 65 years of age, I guess, is one of the outstanding, clearly one of the outstanding organic chemists of our time. A very, very, very good man. And at the time I was deciding graduate schools, I certainly didn't have the feeling of just how good he really is. But my notion really was to go there to work with him. Whereas at MIT, I really didn't have that notion. It was more or less the department at large that was influencing me and having the strong push from this assistant professor at University of Pennsylvania who felt very strongly that I would have a better opportunity in science if I went to MIT than if I had gone to Columbia.
And Harvard, he suggested Harvard also, and you accepted, but you didn't.
Yeah, I got turned off by Harvard. I didn't like their attitude. So it was really the personal contacts that just...
You went up there, did you,
to talk to
interview people?
They put themselves on a pedestal that, whether it's justified or not, it just turned me off. So I didn't really give serious thought to going to Harvard. I thought that their attitudes towards me as a student was not good. And if that's all they cared about me and applying, then I didn't seem to me that it was a place I wanted to go.
You mean they would have taken you? They were prepared to take you, but
oh yeah, they accepted me, but
pat you on the back.
they didn't really care whether you came or not, you know, and they didn't go out of their way to try to make you feel that you were somebody they would really like to have in the department, whereas Columbia and MIT certainly did. And as far as I could tell, the quality of the programs at Columbia and MIT were not that much different than Harvard, that there was any justification for thinking that not going to Harvard would have really missed out on something. At least I didn't have that impression, and as a result of that, I just wrote them off fairly early. So that was not a real consideration. It really was either going to MIT or Harvard or Columbia, and I decided to go to MIT. And again, although it was a last-minute change, I can't say it was a wrong decision. But I think, in retrospect, it would not have been a wrong decision to go to Columbia either. I think things probably wouldn't have changed any.
if I had gone to Columbia versus going to MIT.
Were you accepted at Wisconsin?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Good at Columbia.
Yeah. But it, as I said, it's really something I applied to Wisconsin because it was such a good school. But after I had gotten accepted, I realized it was a foolish thing to have done because I realized there's just no way I was going to go that far away. As I grew up in a family that had strong family ties. It was a big family, as you could imagine from what I mentioned. But it was a tradition of the family on Fridays. We all got together as all the individual families. So my mother and father and my brother and I, with my aunts and uncles and my cousins, would get together with the grandparents in their home and have dinner at least once a week. You know, of course, all holidays were spent that way. But once a week, we always got together as a family. Nobody ever asked any questions where we were having dinner on Friday night. Everybody knew we were having dinner on Friday night. We all had dinner at Grandmom's. Okay, and we all got together. It was just that kind of experience. And it was difficult to break away from that environment, to go to a school that would be 1,000 miles away after having grown up in such a close family type of environment. It was just really unthinkable. So it was going to New York would have been okay. You know, it's not so far. But going to Boston, that caused a lot of difficulties for my parents.
It did.
The idea that I was going to go so far away for them, that didn't please them at all. They were at one hand, they were happy for me and realizing that it was a good school, but on the other hand, they would have preferred me not to have done that. Mm. So that was a difficult time for them and a difficult time for me to say adjust to this notion of being somewhere else.
That it gave your parents a hard time, gave you a hard time. It didn't deter you from going, though.
Oh, no, I didn't. Again, once I had made the decision that this is something that it looked to me like probably it was a good thing to do, I really looked forward to the idea of being up in the Boston area for a while. It offered me, an opportunity of seeing another place, but most importantly, to be at what I believe to be one of the top schools in the country. And I feel that certainly was true and is true. So the idea of what the opportunities being offered far outweighed the notion that I would have a hesitation to do that.
Did you have enough money so you could come back fairly often? You certainly couldn't come back every Friday night. But.
No. I didn't really have the idea that I would have to return on a regular basis, although I kept fairly close contact as well as one can by telephone. I would come back for the holidays. Mm-hmm. And so the idea was to go back for Thanksgiving and for the Christmas, New Year's periods and this type of thing. Mm-hmm. But that was really what it became restricted to.
Yeah.
And that was not hard to do. Mainly by train or bus, never by flying. Flying was one, it was expensive. But the other thing was that that was at the time where that was one of my phobias, was the notion of flying.
Oh, really?
Yeah. This was a phobia that was built into me by my father, actually. He had, during World War II, worked in an airplane factory as part of his national service. He had two children, and I guess they were exempt, but they had to work in some national service. And so in Philadelphia, there was an airplane manufacturing. And that convinced him that these things just were not safe. He saw how these things were built, and he couldn't imagine that this is something that anybody would ever actually trust their life in. So he really transmitted that phobia to me. So at that point in my life, I had never flown, and the notion of flying really turned me off. So I really wouldn't do that. So So it was mainly by train or by bus or by car to get back and forth. I was fortunate enough that after about a year being up there, we were able to buy me a car, so I could, in fact, then just drive back and forth. And that made it a lot easier, as well as making it much more enjoyable being up there. Again, I was able to get a National Science Foundation pre-doctoral fellowship when they existed at that time. And so I had a fellowship throughout my years as a student at MIT.
So you didn't have to work?
No, I didn't have to do any work or any teaching.
Or any research assistantships?
No,
anything?
It was just on a pre-doctoral fellowship. And I finished there in 2 years, or 2.5 years, as a graduate student.
That's rather spectacular, isn't it?
Yeah, it's rather unusual. It's just part of this young man in a rush syndrome that I had, that it's just something that I wanted to do and get do it as fast as I possibly could. And there were no mechanical reasons that people had to spend any longer than that. And although 4 years was the norm, it wasn't required. It was really a matter of research. And if one could do the research, it was possible to finish a lot earlier, as I showed. MIT had a few other people who are quite noteworthy, who really finished their degrees in really record time, which one of the most important figures in modern chemistry, Professor Robert Woodward, was an MIT graduate, and he had a spectacular record, to say the least. He was there as both an undergraduate student and a graduate student, and I don't know what his total stay as an undergraduate and a graduate student, but it wasn't much. He's not only a sheer genius, but also quite a influential individual. There are some people who are geniuses, but really, even though they are a genius, they don't know how to use their talents in a way that is productive. He was not only a genius, but he knew how to use his talents, not only in terms of science, but also in many other areas. I mean, he was an economist of sorts and many other things, but as a scientist, as a chemist, just an extraordinary individual. But the MIT system allowed unusual people to go through the system in a way that would be unhampering to them. And in my own case, it was certainly proved to be the case.
Well, how did it work? I mean, you know, at least the University of Wisconsin, to compare it to what was it like for an entering graduate student?
Well, as a graduate student, you had two things that more or less set a time period, and one was the courses that you were required to take. And the other were a series of special requirements. There it was called a major examination and a research proposition. Here we have a series of cumulative examinations and a research proposition. So I'd say our system here, in many ways, our system here today, in many ways mirrors the system that I went through at MIT. In that sense, I would say that a student here would also be able to finish in 2.5-3 years if a student really put his mind to it, that's what they wanted to do and went all out. So in that respect, I don't think that that our system is that much more overburdening. We do have probably a little bit more course requirements here than we did at MIT. And in that sense, it would be a little bit harder to make it in 2.5 years, you know, maybe 3 years. So it would be about the minimum.
Why didn't they have a large number of course requirements?
Well, I think in part it comes from the feeling there that graduate education is much more the research experience than anything else, and that courses should be held to an absolute minimum. The question is of what that absolute minimum really should be
differs among different people. I don't think that our minimum here is particularly burdensome. I would like to see it modified a little bit, I must say. I think it's a little bit too heavy. But I wouldn't want to see a dramatic change. There, I think they have much more of this feeling, and therefore they have fewer requirements. And I understand in the interval that they've gone even to less than they had when I was there, so that it's almost non-existent. That, I think, is not good. I don't think most students can handle that. And the other thing, I think that they probably feel that the general entering student there is sufficiently more advanced that they don't need as much formal course requirements as perhaps the general student who would enter here as a graduate mm-hmm. student. And we would need to have more of the formal courses to help the students learn these things, not expecting them to learn as much on their own. Whereas at a place at MIT, the notion there would be that you would learn it in part through your research experience and in part from your own self-learning. There was a lot of opportunities and a lot of tradition, more or less, towards this notion of self-learning. So for example, we would organize to the graduate students without any statements from the faculty or any prodding from the faculty or even without their knowledge, would organize self-learning groups where we would do things all the way from not only trying to deal with the courses that we were having. The major exam was the big event as far as graduate school is concerned. This was one examination that you had to pass that covered the entire field of organic chemistry. It happened, in the middle of your second year of study. So after being there a year and a half, and if you didn't pass this exam, then presumably, you had one more chance. You had a second chance to pass it. So you had to pass it one of these two times, and if you didn't, you would flunk out. So it was a major traumatic event, and people really spent tremendous amounts of time studying for that exam.
Did you?
Yes, we all did. And we would organize ourselves into self-help groups in which usually a group of about five or six graduate students would get together to do things like that. But we also would do things like organize ourselves into what we called literature groups. The notion as graduate students, which we try to impress on students, is that they must become aware of the current work that's being done. And you get that knowledge from the current literature, that even in your courses you're not going to get this material, that you must become aware of it. And so we would organize ourselves, and this was a self-initiated activity of the graduate students, into a literature awareness in which each of us were assigned to read certain journals, and then once a week we would get together for an evening and report what we felt were the exciting developments in that particular journal. And it was a tremendously important experience and an enjoyable one. And it's the kinds of things that at the time I probably didn't really appreciate how important that kind of thing really is. But in retrospect, realized that was a very critical activity of being able to get out of graduate school what you really need to get out of graduate school. That the personal interactions among the students offered opportunities of learning just as much as the interactions between students and faculty. Mm-hmm. So the student environment...
Don't think of that usually. I guess perhaps in law school that happens.
Yeah.
But.
Oh yeah, the student environment is a very important part of the learning experience. And I didn't think of it at the time because as a student there, just coming through public school systems, et cetera, you still don't think of the notion that you learn from your fellow students so much. But it's really true. And there at the graduate level, it became very clear that you learned a lot from talking with the other students. And the notion of debating scientific points from these kinds of what we call literature groups or just in the lab as we're doing our experiments, talking about the things that you've read recently and debating whether this guy's really right or wrong, what he's saying. These were things that we tended to do very routinely. And that was an important environment, a good environment. We worked in a large lab, and that has advantages and disadvantages. But one advantage it had was that you had a number of people who were always there that you interacted with, and it helped reinforce this kind of learning experience. The notion that you are a scientist alone in a lab working on great things is absolutely false. The idea of scientific interaction is a critical part of the discovery process, not only for the stimulation that you get, but also just the learning experience of talking with somebody else, just talking with them, learning yourself by having to express your ideas to someone else. That helps you actually begin thinking about things in ways that you might not otherwise, but also seeing their response to the ideas that you're expressing, and of course hearing their own ideas.
You know, I can't remember anybody else saying that. I mean, one always hears about the interaction with the professors.
No, I think that this is an exceedingly important time for me in graduate school, and I would say today is still a very important aspect. That one of the things I try to do in my own group is try to maximize that type of activity. Mm-hmm. That I try to organize my labs having people of different experiences with different kinds of projects so that they can talk to each other and have that learning experience.
Do you think it works?
Yes, I do.
Today, too?
Oh, yeah. And one of the things, you walk through the labs, we have a lot of blackboards. Every place there's a blackboard, and there's always things written on there because it's what the students are doing. They're talking to each other, and that's what it's for. It's to try to give them an opportunity to get together and discuss what's going on. That's a critical part of the educational process. So, yeah, faculty, one doesn't want to underplay the importance of faculty, but they're only part of the experience. The other students are also a critical part of that experience. And that's why it's also important to be at a good university with a good program, because you not only learn from the student, from the teachers, but you also learn from the other students. If the other students aren't any good, you just miss a very major part of that. That's why probably at a graduate level, more than an undergraduate level, this kind of interaction plays a much more critical role.
So you really have to have your professor has to be very good in order to attract good graduate students. So you have to, did you choose whom you wanted to work with? Was that the system there?
Yes.
Your professor, or choosing him?
Choosing a professor was in fact a choice of students. What they did there is also very commonly done in most places, since what we do here as well. The graduate students, when they first enter the university, essentially go on a personal interview with each of the faculty in an area of science. So that going into MIT, I was a graduate student in organic chemistry, I would then see all of the faculty who would be practicing organic chemistry. And then they would see us usually either individually or with one other or two other people and talk about their research. And after having then talked with each person, then you decide with which group you want to associate. And that's the way I picked my major professor there. Really more picked it on what I felt would be some of the interesting science, rather than picking it on the basis of the person who had the best reputation. Mm-hmm. So it turned out I did not work at MIT for the person who had the highest scientific stature in the department. But I ended up working with somebody who was at that time much younger. He was an associate professor, so he had just received tenure shortly before. And mainly chose it based on what I thought would be an interesting project.
It's a big choice, isn't it?
It's a very big choice. Oh. It's more of an important choice than I had realized at the time, because I might have made a different decision if I had realized how important it was. Part of what influenced my decision was also the fact that I wanted to make sure I was going to be working in a project that I would be able to do in a short period of time. Again, this time interval came into play. So as I looked at the projects, I wanted to work in an area that I felt would be exciting, but one that I judged would be one I could move ahead fairly rapidly. It turned out to be a very fortunate choice because it laid the foundation for a very major area of synthetic chemistry. So it was, in fact, scientifically very important, but it also turned out to meet my requirements as well. And as I said, it led to me being able to finish in a relatively short period of time.
And he had other good graduate students, even though he was a young professor.
Yeah, the group probably was not the best scientifically of the department at large. But I would also have to say that probably was not as consequential because my interactions were as much with people in other groups as it was with people within the group.
Oh, I would have thought you wouldn't have much chance to interact with the others.
No, that's not true. That actually was not a problem. Many of the students tended to live in what was called the graduate house. And as a result of that, you saw at least all the students who were from outside. If they weren't from the Boston area and living at home and commuting, they were more or less living at the graduate house, at least for the first year. Although some tended to move out of the graduate house in subsequent years, which I also did. For the first year, you all tended to live there. And as a result, you really got to know just about everybody who entered in your class. Mm-hmm. So yeah, you would not know necessarily people who were more advanced graduate students in the other class, in the other groups, but you did know all the students in your class.
Your cohort.
Right, your cohorts, your colleagues.
Sociologists, yeah.
And these people would tend more or less because you're going through the same requirements. So our study groups were always those from our class, mm-hmm. and they would be across the board. So you know there would be only I was the only person from my research group in our literature group, for example.
I see. Yeah.
And the other people in our literature group were from four other groups. So we formed and that's what mainly came about because we got to know each other from various things, from our living arrangements, and just seemed to form a natural group, and we agreed to do this. So it was a situation where I don't think it was so critical that it had to be just within the group, the kind of interactions, that with few exceptions, they were all fairly proximal to each other, and one had a lot of cross-group interactions, cross-group fertilizations. And that was, I think, is very good. That's not true of every place. And that was something that I also did realize to some extent subsequently. It certainly was true at MIT, but for example, Harvard, it was not true. There, the groups were very isolated from each other, and this kind of group cross-group interactions was not very common. So I was, again, fortunate to have placed myself in an environment where it was strong. And Columbia was also strong, and here it's also strong. So
it always has been.
Well, I can't say that because I haven't been here always, but it certainly is strong now, and I'd say it's not as strong as I would like it to be at times, but it's pretty good. And again, a place like Harvard, for example, it doesn't occur at all. Mm-hmm. So I think it's a much better situation where you have that. It's a good opportunity for students, I think, as well as for faculty, because not only it gives us a chance to, let's say, see other students, but we see each other, the faculty sees each other. That was true at MIT, which probably also helped create the atmosphere that the students would see other students, whereas at other places, the faculty don't see each other, and that sort of helps sets the tone that the students don't tend to see each other either. So I think in that respect there is a certain mimicking by the students of what they see the faculty do. If they see the faculty really talk to each other, then they say, well, maybe that's what maybe that's what we should do. We should talk to each other. Mm-hmm. And I think they do. And MIT had that environment, which I enjoyed. It was it's a very important part, I think, of what happened. And then the person I happened to work with had this, what I enjoy as far as this tremendously, this tremendous ability of being able to explain very clearly large bodies of information, almost the same syndrome of that Alan Day had, Herb House has, and being able to systematize things very, very well and to be able to explain these in a very clear, understandable fashion. He is extraordinarily good at that. And again, played a very important role in my own development. So I think that that was another aspect that I enjoyed a lot. He was not a very personable type of individual. In some ways, he gave you the impression of being very shy, almost afraid to be in front of a class. But once he started to lecture, it was obviously clear how good he really was. So we always had a very proper, a very professional relationship, but it was never a very, on a personal basis, it was never a very close relationship. That was a big difference.
Is he still there?
No, he's not. He eventually went he got some special professorship at Georgia Institute of Technology and moved to Georgia Institute of Technology. So he's no longer at MIT.
Well, perhaps we better stop.